From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Israeli-Palestinian clashes after a possible revenge killing. How should the international community respond now to the crisis in Iraq?
It is hard at this point. It's become so disintegrated and so large a problem that, right, you know, now it's even much more challenging to know how to deal with it.
Phone apps help diabetics during Ramadan, and experts are divided on socioeconomic benefits of the World Cup. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Tensions between Israelis and Palestinians are running high, fueling a possible revenge killing following the funeral of three kidnapped Jewish teens. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli police fired tear gas at hundreds of stone-throwing Palestinians in an Arab suburb of Jerusalem. The clashes erupted after a Palestinian youth from the neighborhood was found dead. Residents say he was kidnapped outside a mosque and killed in revenge for the murder of three Israeli teenagers who were allegedly abducted by Palestinian militants. Mohammed, a relative of the Arab victim, told Israel Radio that eyewitnesses saw the youth being forced into a car, which sped away. Israeli police are not sure who is responsible. They say it may have been a revenge killing by Jews or a criminal act, such as a feud between Arab clans.
ישנם מספר כיווני חקירה. אני מבקש גם מתושבים ירושלים וגם מכולם.
Police Commissioner Yohanan Danino urged the public not to draw conclusions and to act with restraint. He said both nationalistic and criminal motives are being investigated. Either way, many Palestinians are convinced that Israeli settlers are responsible, and that is further raising tensions between Jews and Arabs. The murder came a day after tens of thousands of Israelis attended the funeral of the three kidnapped Jewish seminary students in an outpouring of national unity and solidarity. Bereaved families chanted the mourner's prayer as the teenagers were laid to rest side by side. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The self-appointed leader of the newly proclaimed Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is demanding that all Muslims emigrate there and take up arms. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi posted an audio message on Islamist websites saying the new state is for all Muslims, regardless of skin color or nationality. He said Syria is not for the Syrians and Iraq is not for Iraqis. Baghdadi said the holy month of Ramadan is the perfect time for all Muslims to take up weapons and fight. Sunni extremists from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant proclaimed a sovereign state for Muslims earlier this week. ISIL has seized much of northern Iraq and is one of the rebel groups fighting to topple the Syrian government. Paul Salin is the vice president for policy and research at the Middle East Institute. Tuesday, we spoke with him about ISIL declaring a new caliphate in Iraq and Syria. Today, we ask what the international community should do now in reaction to the conflict in the region.
It is hard at this point. It's become so disintegrated and so large a problem that, right, you know, now it's even much more challenging to know how to deal with it. There is no easy fix, and there's nothing that... there's no one thing that if you did it, it would solve the crisis. But in general, I would say a number of things. First of all, the regional powers, as well as the international community and the Western powers, first of all, have to raise this issue of the Syria-Iraq crisis high up in their foreign policy agendas. That the leaders wake up in the morning should be worrying about this and not putting it down, burying it under, many, many other issues. This is a very serious threat to regional and international security. It has to be treated as so. Secondly, there needs to be, a comprehensive or a sort of a strategic approach that simply deciding on, should we send a few drones or not is not, that's a very... narrow way to think about it. This is a very complicated situation. The West has to talk with its allies in the region, which is Turkey and the Gulf states in particular. The international community is talking with Iran, which is the other player in this. Iran and Russia, in a sense. Everybody is losing from this conflict. Iran is losing. The Arab states are losing. The West is losing. It's a lose-lose situation. Now, where that leadership can come from to get the regional and national community to begin thinking together about this problem is hard to say. Maybe President Obama 4 years ago had the wherewithal to do it. Right now, he seems pretty isolated. But it does require serious worries, serious thinking, serious efforts. Diplomacy is going to have to be part of it. The politics of Iraq have to be more inclusive. The U.S., I think, is doing its best to put pressure in that direction. If Iran can do some as well, that would be very helpful. The U.S. tried to convene Geneva II and get a deal for Syria, but the other side didn't go for it. But simply ignoring the crisis and hoping that it'll go away has not worked either. So difficult as it is, it does require a lot of difficult thinking, difficult choices, but a lot of attention.
It doesn't seem that the fight is wearing down. It doesn't seem like the participants are getting tired of this war. Matter of fact, it seems like they're actually getting more involved over there.
I think these things go in, you know, phases and ebbs and flows. I think what we've seen, what we saw in Syria over the past 2 years is really the breakaway of a lot of the Sunni Sunni areas from the central government. We've seen that, you know, played out over 2 years. Iraq was fairly united until a few weeks ago, and certainly was more or less united when the Americans left at the end of 2011. But the policies of the Maliki government, Maliki himself, concentrating power in his own hands, excluding both Kurdish and Sunni politicians really from the you know, the center of power, alienated these groups, and now we're seeing a breakaway of Sunni provinces of Iraq. That might, you know, that I think is a historic change that is not going to be reversed unless, you know, except as part of maybe a new federal agreement, a new kind of decentralization of power in Iraq. So I think this break-off of the Sunni provinces, we've seen an uptick in violence because, you know, like when a big iceberg breaks away, there's a lot of cracking and a lot of sound that goes on, and then it breaks away. I think that's what we've seen. So I don't think necessarily means you can't necessarily project, you know, from 2 weeks of fighting, whether that will mean more fighting or whether we might enter into a period of consolidation in this, what I've called in an article sort of facetiously, Syriac. You know, part of Syria and part of Iraq is now a new space, Sunni-dominated, with borders on Turkey, potentially borders on Jordan and Saudi Arabia as well, so allies. Whether ISIS continues to control it or other groups, I don't know, but so there might be a period of consolidation as well.
Paul Salen, Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute. The United States has welcomed Japan's decision to adopt a new policy of collective self-defense, allowing its military to engage in a wide range of operations. VOA's Victor Beatty reports, despite criticism from China and South Korea, a U.S. Defense Department spokesman sees the policy revision as fostering the U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific region.
U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf Tuesday welcomed the new policy announcement, saying Washington has followed the extensive discussions within Japan in defending allies and participating in U.N. peacekeeping operations.
We welcome the government of Japan's new policy regarding collective self-defense and related security matters. As you know, the U.S.-Japan alliance is one of our most important partnerships, security partnerships, and we value efforts by Japan to strengthen that security cooperation, and also value Japan's efforts to maintain openness and transparency throughout this decision-making process that's led up to this new policy.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel called it an important step for Japan as it seeks to make a greater contribution to regional and global peace and security. The new policy, he said, also complements our ongoing efforts to modernize our alliance through the revision of bilateral guidelines for defense cooperation. Last October, both countries agreed to revise 1997 guidelines with the goal, Hagel said, of a more balanced and effective alliance where our two militaries are full partners working side by side and with regional partners to enhance peace and security. Japan has been operating under a U.S.-drafted post-war constitution that includes Article 9, which renounces war and the threat and use of force to settle disputes, and states that land, sea, and air forces, along with war potential, will never be maintained. China, which is involved in a territorial dispute with Japan, says Tokyo is challenging the post-war order and raising regional tensions. The move is also opposed by some in South Korea, which, along with China, was a major victim of Japanese colonial aggression in the 20th century. Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby Tuesday said there is no concern the move will inflame tensions in the Asia-Pacific region.
Now, there's a lot of work left to do inside the Japanese government on this policy change that they're seeking. It's a democracy. They've got a diet that needs to vote on this. I mean, there's a lot of work left to do. But we frankly think it's a very encouraging sign, and it will help inform the revision of the defense guidelines, the bilateral defense guidelines that we have with Japan. So it helps inform that process, which, as you know, is ongoing. So for us, we find it very, very helpful. And there's no reason from our perspective to believe or to worry that it'll make tensions worse. And quite the contrary, we think it will help with security and stability in the region.
Brad Glosserman, executive director of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum Security Analysis Think Tank, says in no way is Prime Minister Shinzo Abe turning away from Japan's commitment to what they call proactive pacifism.
The Japanese position is very much that this is a much-needed change that will allow them to more actively contribute to regional security and to work with allies and partners in a very narrowly constrained set of circumstances. And it's always conditioned legally, politically, and I think most importantly publicly, by this notion of pacifism. By no means is Japan making a radical shift in its policies.
Glosserman says the United States has pressed Japan for decades to do more in the context of regional security. He says Japan has been reluctant to do so given its post-war constitution and skepticism of military force for anything other than defense of the homeland. He says the United States today faces many new threats.
And I think we've recognized as well that our partners are capable of contributing more than they have in the past. Not because the U.S. is disengaging, but again, because I think that the Japanese or the Koreans, the Australians are far more capable and have their own abilities to contribute to the defense of, and to respond to certain threats. And we would be remiss and frankly foolish to not try to tap those abilities in ways that make the most sense and are the most efficient.
Glosserman says the U.S. rebalance to Asia-Pacific is premised on strengthening relations with allies.
This actually is a form of the rebalance. It is an attempt to modernize and update the U.S.-Japan alliance. So it fits very much within the framework of the rebalance generally.
China's state-run People's Daily Tuesday called the Japanese policy change a dangerous move that will lead to security worries for other Asian countries. The New York Times quotes analysts who say the policy change will make it easier for Japan to forge new military alliances with nations like the Philippines, who have similar territorial disputes with China. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
For the first time in its 236-year history, the U.S. Navy has a woman as its second-highest-ranking officer. Michelle Howard was promoted Tuesday to a 4-star admiral and assumed her new duties as Vice Chief of Naval Operations. Zlata Sahok reports Howard has made history throughout her military career.
Michelle Howard received her 4th star at a ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery with her family and fellow servicemen looking on.
If you don't believe today was a first, when I called to order 4-star shoulder boards for women, they didn't exist. A special contract was let, and you folks are seeing the first set in the history of the United States Navy.
Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus was the promoting officer.
The Navy picked the best officer to be the VCNO. That's the only thing that happened here today.
Since 1982, when she graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy, Howard has achieved many historic firsts in her career. She was the first African-American woman to achieve a 3-star rank in the U.S. Armed Forces, as well as being the first woman to achieve the rank of admiral in the Navy. She also was the first African-American woman to command a naval ship. Chief of Naval Operations Jonathan Greenert says the honors mean extra obligations.
She will bear the burden of a role model, and she is ready to bear that very well. And I'm very excited about that because we need lots more women in the Navy.
Howard was in the Pentagon during the September 11, 2001 terrorist attack, and in 2009 participated in the Naval Task Force dispatched to rescue the U.S.-flagged merchant vessel Maersk Alabama and its captain Richard Phillips, who had been kidnapped by Somali pirates.
It was about 3 days into the job when we got word that Captain Phillips had been kidnapped.
American women serving in the military have broken many barriers in recent years and can compete for positions that were once closed to them. Howard says her promotion can serve as further encouragement.
My rank today lets them know that they can go from junior enlisted to MCPON of the Navy or from ensign to admiral.
Howard is the third woman in the U.S. military to reach a four-star rank. One is in the Army and the other is in the Air Force.
We, as a Navy and as a nation, have just got to quit wasting the talent and ability based on race or gender or anything else.
Officials from all military service branches have announced plans to open combat positions to women who meet physical or performance standards by 2016. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
The number of deaths from West Africa's Ebola outbreak continues to rise. The World Health Organization says 467 people have now died. The WHO has confirmed or suspects 759 cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. In eastern Sierra Leone, in the community of Kanema, Dr. Mohamed Vandi is the chief medical officer.
I believe we can contain this here in Kanema. And if we do that, we can stop, we can save the rest of the country from getting the infection. We can control it here. And that's why we are even mounted another checkpoint outside Kanema, just outside Kanema. That's the only road leading to the rest of the country.
Kanema is now the front line in Sierra Leone's fight against Ebola. Senegal has become the first Francophone country to pilot a mobile phone platform called M-Ramadan, which helps people with diabetes safely manage their health while fasting. Diabetics who are testing the new app say it has been quite helpful. Jennifer Lazuta has more from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
People living with diabetes in Senegal can now receive, for the first time, free daily text messages with recommendations for fasting before, during, and after the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The mobile phone campaign, which is known as M-Ramadan, is part of the Be Healthy, Be Mobile program, a joint initiative by the World Health Organization and the International Telecommunication Union that aims to help countries fight non-communicable diseases. The goal of M-Ramadan is to help diabetic patients in Senegal safely manage their illness and reduce the number of emergency hospitalizations that normally peak during Ramadan. 26-year-old Marie Gadio, who was diagnosed with diabetes at age 13, said living with diabetes during Ramadan is not easy.
C'est un peu difficile parce que ici au Sénégal, la plupart des musulmans, la plupart des gens sont des musulmans.
She says it is sometimes difficult because here in Senegal, the majority of people are Muslims, and because of that, no one is eating during the day. She says certain diabetics just fast as they want, without knowing anything. But now our technology is developing, and people can take advice from this program. While Islam exempts anyone too young, old, pregnant, or not in good health from fasting, many diabetics say they do try to abstain from food and drink during Ramadan. They also sometimes stop taking insulin injections, which are needed to regulate blood glucose levels. Dr. Maimouna Indoor Mbai, a professor of internal medicine and diabetology, who works at the Mark Sincali National Diabetes Center in Dakar, said diabetics can face a number of complications while fasting.
The first risk is hypoglycemia, which can be very harmful for the brain in particular. There is also a risk of hyperglycemia because when they fast, their diabetic is less controlled. They cannot take their medication on a regular basis as they do on a normal day. And this is a risk and exposes to complications.
Mbai said diabetics are also at an increased risk of dehydration. People with diabetes who have existing conditions, such as chronic kidney problems, are usually not advised to fast, as such conditions can worsen. She said that all diabetics should consult with their physicians before deciding if it is safe not to eat. 26-year-old Ndiaga Diop, who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 8 years old, said M-Ramadan is proving to be a useful tool for people with diabetes in Senegal. He says before, we had many diabetics who didn't know what to do during Ramadan, whether they should fast or not. But now with the program, it helps you know what to do while fasting. Each day, we receive messages with advice about what to do or not to do, he says. So it's a very good thing and really helps people. Some of the messages include reminding people to drink at least a liter of water each morning before beginning the fast, how to adjust the timing and dosage of diabetes medications, and not to eat too many sugary foods such as dates in the evening. Once Ramadan is over, participants will continue to receive messages about the importance of checking in with a doctor to make sure their diabetes is still well controlled and to maintain a healthy and active lifestyle. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
As fans enjoy football's World Cup, Brazilian authorities are expressing pleasure over the boost, they say, the tournament is giving the country's economy. However, independent analysts who study such mega events are less enthusiastic. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Rio de Janeiro.
The 2014 World Cup has injected an estimated $15 billion into the Brazilian economy and created many jobs. This, according to the head of the government's Embratur Tourism Board, Vicente Neto.
Regarding the human legacy, the numbers are extraordinary. The creation of 1 million jobs in the country due to this great event, 1 million jobs, or 15% of all the jobs created this year in Brazil.
The government has invested $11 billion in stadiums and infrastructure and another $2 billion in security. It is expected to spend billions more preparing for the 2016 Olympic Games in Rio. But an analyst who studies such mega events, architecture and urbanism professor at Rio de Janeiro's Fluminense Federal University, Chris Gaffney, believes these figures are exaggerated.
I don't think that they've invested enough money to create those kind of permanent jobs. I mean, this, in the scale of the Brazilian economy, we're not looking at actually that much money being invested. So it's $30 billion in a $1 trillion economy.
Another expert, Lisa Del Pinerotti of George Washington University in the United States, says the real economic benefits of such events are less tangible and more long-term.
There's a lot of transfer of knowledge, so people are learning more about hospitality. There's also the broadcast center where they're being trained in how to use technology. And so I think it's in the media sector, a lot in the hospitality industry, and also in licensing and merchandising, retail.
Chris Gaffney believes the money being spent benefits very few Brazilians.
The World Cup and Olympics are part of an extractive business model that moves around the world very freely, and a top-down business model that uses the interests of local political and economic elites to make money for international corporations.
Del Pinerotti disagrees.
Yes, there's been a lot of money spent here, but we have to realize that the infrastructure that they've built up around the World Cup is something that will last and stays in the country.
Other analysts say the Cup may help the Brazilian economy, but it also boosts inflation and public debt. Less than half of the Brazilians in a recent poll believed that hosting the Cup was a good idea. And there have been many demonstrations against the Cup, though they have declined since the tournament began. Nevertheless, many Brazilians are proud to host the World Cup and the 600,000 foreign visitors it brings. They hope that they will spread the good word about Brazil when they return home. Scott Bob, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.